61 years now, and he's going to talk to us about plant diseases and what we can do about them. So I'll hand straight over to him.
Okay, thanks very much, Graham. Sort of says on here what I'm going to talk about. So what I'm going to spend most of my time talking about is lots of different plant diseases and give you some ideas of the sorts of organisms that cause disease. What I'll do, though, to start off with is just to explain a little bit about the importance of plant disease. So why are we interested in diseases of plants? Then I'm going to talk about what causes these things. And then I'm going to do a section where I'll talk a little bit about some of my research, which is mainly on developing diagnostics, ways of identifying plant pathogens. And then I'll finish off a little bit by talking about some methods that we might want to use for controlling diseases of plants. So you're probably all familiar with lots of diseases of plants, and I've got a little diagram down here which kind of shows a whole range of different symptoms that you might get on a diseased plant. And I'm sure you've seen these sorts of things on plants in your gardens, that you might have symptoms on the leaves of the plant. You might have symptoms on the fruits of the plants, so rots on the fruits of the plants. You might have wilting plants due to diseases. And you might also have things in the soil which are affecting what causes disease. So to start off with explaining the importance of plant pathogens, first important point to note is that plants are covered in microbes. So what I've got here is just a couple of images. The top one is an image of the leaf of a plant. It's a microscopic image of a leaf of a plant. And what we're looking at here is epidermal cells. And the little green dots on here are bacteria. Okay, so that's a lettuce leaf taken from a supermarket. Looking at it in fluorescent microscopy, all of those little green dots are bacteria. So surface of a leaf is covered in bacteria. Just for a size, that's the stomata. That red bit there is just the stomata on the leaf. Okay? So masses of bacteria all over the surface of a leaf. Similarly, if you take a lettuce leaf and you put it on a petri dish with some agar on it, and then you take the leaf off a few seconds later and leave the petri dish, incubate the petri dish, this is the sort of thing you'll find after a couple of days. All of those are different fungi, lots of different fungi and yeasts which are on the surface of your plant. Okay? So your plant is covered in microbes. You're eating them all the time. When you're eating this lunch in a few minutes, you're going to be eating lots of microbes. However, the nice thing to know is that most of these microbes are completely harmless. They're harmless to us, and they're harmless to the plants. So most of these things are of no consequence at all. They're just living there as what we call saprophytes, just living off nutrients released from the plants. Occasionally, though, you get certain organisms which are pathogenic to the plant. And these can be quite important. And there's some figures on here which are some data from a number of years ago, which I don't want you to read all of the data, but I've just underlined the data for one particular plant species, a potatoes. And what we've got here is data kind of showing how much potential yield there is for potato, and then how much is lost each year due to diseases. And if you look at that, what it's kind of telling you is that for potato, about 20% of potential agricultural yield is lost every year due to diseases. About another 6% is lost due to insects and a little bit more due to weeds. And if we work this on for all of the different plant species that are down there, it's kind of estimated that that agricultural yield, about 10 to 15% of potential agricultural yield is being lost every year just because of diseases. Okay? And in some parts of the world, it's going to be higher than that. In other parts of the world, it's lower. So in the UK and in Europe, we might have lots of control mechanisms which kind of reduce that a little bit, whereas in sub-Saharan Africa, the proportions might be a bit higher. So that's a global average of yield losses. So what are these things that are causing diseases? Diseases of plants are a little bit different to diseases of animals in that when we think of diseases of plants, we're thinking of biotic factors. We're thinking of viruses, bacteria, fungi as causing diseases. So we're not thinking of syndromes, disorders of plants. Sometimes when we think of human diseases, we think of disorders as being diseases. Okay, so we call Parkinson's disease a disease, but it's more of a disorder. But in plants, we always think of microbes as being causal agents of disease. So the sorts of things that we're talking about are, first of all, viruses. Viruses are quite important organisms for causing disease on plants. Plant viruses, though, are generally very simple organisms. They're made up of usually a little bit of nucleic acid wrapped up in multiple copies of a protein. So to give an example, this is what we would call a rod-shaped virus, where you've got a little bit of nucleic acid, and then that's wrapped up in multiple copies of a single protein. And that's all the virus is made up of. And when you were to look, if you were to look at that virus down an electron microscope, and that's the only way you can see a virus, what you would see is these rod-shaped particles. So that's a tip, and plant viruses tend to come in one of two shapes. They're either rod-shaped or they're what we call isometric. And in isometric, again, you've got multiple copies of a coat protein, and inside that you've got the bit of nucleic acid. The kind of structure of an isometric plant virus, if you want to imagine it, is essentially the same as the structure of a football or the old-style footballs, in that the way that the subunits are arranged are in groups of kind of five proteins and six proteins, hexamers and pentamers. So if you look at this structure here, we've got a hexamer there, five coat proteins, a pentamer there, five coat proteins, and a hexamer there, six. And so the typical structure of an isometric plant virus is like the structure of a football. Okay. When it comes to how viruses get around, they get transmitted mainly by insect vectors, by aphids and leafhoppers. And what these insects will do is they come along, they feed on one plant, so they get to the sap of the plant, and that is in the sap of the plant that you find the viruses. Those viruses will then either stick to the mouth parts of the insect, or they will get taken up into the gut and get into the salivary glands. And then when that insect goes and feeds on another plant, that's when it transmits the virus to the next plant. So that's the main way that viruses will get transmitted. There are a few other ways that one or two virus isolates might get transmitted. Some will be transmitted through the soil by nematodes, or some might get transmitted by biting insects such as grasshoppers. There are some that will be transferred from one plant to another by contact. One of the best examples of this is a virus called tobacco mosaic virus, and anyone that smokes will be a superb vector for tobacco mosaic virus. You'll be able to transmit it to our tomato plants just by walking through our glasshouse and just rubbing against the plants, because you've got it all over you. You've got it in your lungs as well, for what it's worth, because I know I've got a colleague who used to work at Oxford, and her husband was a surgeon. He did biopsies on some lung cancer patients and managed to get tobacco mosaic virus out of those. So it's all over the place. And then there are some viruses that are transmitted by seed as well. What do viruses do for plants, so when you're looking at your plants and you're wanting to diagnose them and work out if you've got a viral disease, the sort of thing you're looking for is probably these kind of colour deviations on the plant. They might be on the leaves, they might even be on the flowers. So the classical symptoms of a virus infection are things that we refer to as mosaics or striping. And on the left there, you can see the typical symptoms of tomato mosaic virus, or tobacco mosaic virus, essentially the same. Those yellow blotches on the leaves. Sometimes they will cause dwarfing of the plants. So we've got the barley yellow dwarf in the middle. And then there's this one plant virus is actually commercially quite useful, which is this thing called tulip break virus, where if you see these tulips, which are coming out at the moment with these nice colour deviations in the flowers, that's caused by a virus, that colour deviation. Normally what the virus is doing to the plant is it's just reducing the yield. The virus is just replicating inside the plant, and therefore the plant is using all of its machinery to replicate the virus. Most viruses won't kill a plant. There's no point for a virus in having a dead plant, because then the virus can't replicate. So normally they will just reduce yield within that plant. Sometimes they cause slightly different types of symptoms. They might cause some malformations or leaf curls or tumours on the plants. So we've got one at the top there called pea leaf roll, where the leaves will fold over. Something called tomato spotted wilt, which kind of the name explains what it does. A citrus one, and potato virus. Why you sometimes in your potatoes you'll find these little necrotic lesions, these brown lesions all over the surface of your potato, and that might well be down to a potato virus. Normally, if we get these virus infections in an annual plant, we don't worry about it too much. We just accept there's going to be a yield loss. The problems with viruses tend to come if they occur in trees, because what happens then is that tree becomes a reservoir of the virus and it can get transmitted very readily to fresh plants. And so your best bet, if you've got an infected tree, is probably to end up destroying that tree to stop it spreading the virus elsewhere. But in an annual plant, normally you just live with it. You can't apply chemicals to get rid of virus infections of plants. So there's nothing you can apply to try and remove these things. Next sort of diseases that I'll just mention are bacterial diseases. So this is where the bacteria gets into the plant and causes disease. And again, there's a whole variety of different symptoms that the bacteria might be causing. One of the most common ones is something that we refer to as wilt diseases. So what's happening with a wilt disease is that bacteria will get into the plant through the soil, and it will get in through wound sites in the roots. It'll then block water movement in the plant. So what the bacteria actually does is it coats itself in an exopolysaccharide. So it coats itself in a chemical. Essentially, the bacteria is doing it as a protection against plant defences. But what the result of that is that the xylem then blocks up with all of this kind of gum that forms in the xylem, and it's that then causes the plant to wilt. So the restriction of water movement, you get your wilty plant. And you might get this in tomatoes, or on the left there, we've got a banana plant showing wilting. So there are a number of different plant species that could end up with wilt diseases. One that you might also be familiar with is this thing called the soft rot bacteria. So this is a different type of bacteria. You'll often find it in potatoes. So you may well have come across your bags of potatoes where now and again you find there's a horrible smell coming out of that bag of potatoes. And that's often because you've got this soft rot going on in there. So this is a bacterium which gets into the potatoes. It usually gets in through wound sites or lesions that have been developed because of other infections. And then it produces enzymes which break down the cell walls. And it's that breaking down of the cell walls that then causes the softening, and that in turn then results in the smell in the case of the potatoes. On the left, we've got the same kind of symptoms, but in that case, it's in a corn plant where we've got this soft rotting bacteria. Then you can get this kind of spotting and leaf blights on the surface of the leaf. Sometimes these will be fairly small lesions, like the kind of thing we're seeing here, where you just get little spots on the surface of the leaf caused by the bacterial infections. Sometimes, though, these things will become much more severe, and you get what we refer to as a blight symptom, where the whole leaf will die because of the infection. Essentially, the main difference between what's going on in a kind of a leaf spotting situation and this more severe blight is the amount of toxin that the bacteria might be producing. So these bacteria will be producing toxins that are toxic to the plant. They're not toxic to us, but they're toxic to the plant. And depending on what kind of toxins are being produced and the kind of levels, then you might end up getting these very severe symptoms such as this, which is fire blight on apples. Or you might just get these small leaf spotting symptoms that look something like this. The type of disease that I'm kind of more interested in, and actually most of my research, or my bacterial research is on, is a rather unique group of bacteria called the phytoplasmas. And these are a particularly unique group of bacteria, first of all, because they're a type of bacteria which doesn't have a cell wall around them. Another reason that they're quite unique as a type of bacteria is that they have extremely small genomes as bacteria go. They're actually amongst the smallest genomes of any self-replicating organisms. So they have tiny genomes. They don't encode many genes at all as bacteria go. They're bacteria that are transmitted between plants by insects, mainly leaf hoppers and plant hoppers. And what's also unique about this particular group of bacteria is that despite having a very small genome, they can replicate in both the plant and in the insect that transmits them. So they will develop in both. In fact, there are some people that argue that what's actually going on here is that the leafhopper vectors use the bacteria as a way of manipulating the plant. The leafhopper essentially ejects that bacteria in the plant, and then that, in turn, results in certain symptoms that make that plant more conducive to leafhoppers. Because the sorts of symptoms that you get are yellowing of plants, and yellowing is something that attracts insects. You get leafy plants, much leafier plants, small leaves, and you also get volatile chemicals being emitted from those plants which attract the insects. So it's essentially a symbiotic relationship between the leafhopper and the phytoplasma. The phytoplasmas don't do any harm to the leafhoppers, but they're able to replicate in them. Just to give some examples of the sorts of diseases, they don't show up very well. But this here is a disease that, in fact, I only took this picture 2 days ago because I've only just got back from Oman. But this is Lyme witch's broom in Oman. And although it doesn't show up very clearly, on this part of the tree here, you can see some limes growing. And then this bit of the tree here, what you've got is a yellow bit of plant, which is much leafier than the rest of the plant. And in fact, one of the things I didn't realise till I was out there the other day is that most of the acid lime tree is very spiky, so you wouldn't want to touch it. But the bit that's infected with the phytoplasma, all the spikes have gone. You can do what you want to it. So it removes all the spikiness and it creates this very soft tissue, and yellow tissue, and very small leaves. Another example of a phytoplasma infection is this thing here called napier grass stunt. Now, napier grass, or elephant grass, is a grass that's grown in parts of sub-Saharan Africa as cattle fodder. And normally, elephant grass, as the name implies, is quite tall. In fact, this is the normal height of elephant grass. That's the normal height of a human. We're looking at plants that are about 12 foot tall. When it's infected with this phytoplasma, this is what it looks like. It's about a foot tall. Not very good for cattle fodder. And that's just down to a bacterial infection. And then we've got another example here, basil little leaf, where you can see a healthy plant. And I'm sure you've guessed which one is the infected one. One with a little leaf. We don't get many of these bacteria in this country, but there is one example which I'm sure you're all familiar with, and that's this thing here. When you buy your poinsettias at Christmas, all of your poinsettias contain a phytoplasma. It's the poinsettia which makes that plant small and bushy. Normally a poinsettia is a very big, leggy plant, but because of this phytoplasma which is in all the poinsettias, it's that makes it very small and bushy. One of the interesting things, we didn't know about that until about 10 years ago, and for many, many years, and in fact still, we have quarantine restrictions on phytoplasmas being imported into the UK. So we have lots of quarantine restrictions, and at the ports, people have to test plant material to make sure it's not infected with phytoplasma. And then every year, we import thousands and thousands of this thing at Christmas time from Holland and from the rest of Europe, full of phytoplasma. Fortunately, we don't have the vector that can transmit it, so it's not a huge problem, but next time you get your poinsettia plant at Christmas, remember it's got a bacteria in it that's making it small. The other main group then of organisms that cause diseases on plants are fungi and oomycetes. And these are really defined as the types of things which are transmitted between plants by spores, either in the soil or spores which get transmitted through the air. These aren't examples of plant pathogens. These are just pretty pictures showing how spores get emitted from fungi, just to remind you of what fungi look like. And these are what we would refer to as saprophytes, because these are living off dead plant material. But essentially what happens in an infected plant is that the same kind of thing. These spores will get emitted from an infected plant, they will go to another plant, and they will then invade the plant tissue, grow inside the plant tissue, and access their nutrients from the plant. And they will get transmitted by spores, these sorts of things that we can see here. So let's give a couple of examples. I'm sure some of you have seen these sorts of things around, powdery mildews. Powdery mildews is a generic name for a group of fungi. Powdery mildews are lots of different species that will infect different hosts. So I've got here two examples of a powdery mildew, one on wheat, one on rose. Important thing to bear in mind about these sorts of organisms, such as the powdery mildews, is the one which infects wheat won't touch rose. It won't go anywhere near rose, it won't grow on rose, okay? It will only infect wheat. And similarly, the one which infects rose will only infect rose. So if you get a powdery mildew on one of your plants, if you get a powdery mildew on your tomato plants, for example, it's highly unlikely that that will get onto any other plants. These things are very species specific as a group of organisms, okay? To show you how powdery mildew works, I've got kind of three videos that follow on from each other here. So this is powdery mildew, and what we've got here is the spore of the fungus landing on the surface of the leaf. So this is the leaf surface here, this is an epidermal cell down here, this is the fungal spore, and what that fungal spore will do is it will germinate, and it will then produce a thing called a germ tube, this thing here, and that will penetrate through, in the case of powdery mildews, into the epidermal cells. It's going to get there in a minute. Now, what this particular type of fungus does is it accesses nutrients from the cells of the plant. So it doesn't kill the plant's cells. So what we've got here, the way this fungus works, is all of this is fungal tissue, but the plant cell is still alive. The plant cell is still intact, And what's happening is that the fungus produces this structure inside the cell, and it then accesses nutrients from the plant through this structure. It's something that we refer to as a haustorium. And through that, it then accesses nutrients out of the plant. Oops, we've done that one. The mouse won't move to the side. Once it's done that, so our fungus has now formed the haustorium, the epidermal cells, it'll start getting nutrients out of the plant, and the fungus, in this case, will then start to grow across the surface of the leaf. So the fungus forms these mycelia that grow across the surface of the leaf, and this is the white stuff that you see as the powdery mildew on your leaf surface. And as it's doing this, it's tapping into more and more cells to get more and more nutrients out of the plant. So it's growing across the surface, tapping into the epidermal cells, sucking out the nutrients so it can grow across the surface of the leaf. And then once it's finished doing all that, which will probably take it about a week or 2 weeks, it'll then germinate and produce spores. So in the case of powdery mildew, what it does is it produces these long chains of spores, which then emerge away from the surface of the leaf that you can see here. These chains of spores will emerge. Eventually, they'll get to a position where the wind will catch the outer spores, and in a minute, they'll get blown away. So those spores will then get blown off and transmitted onto fresh plant material. So that's kind of how the powdery mildews work as a type of fungus. Okay? Other types of fungal diseases that you may have seen are things like the rust fungi. And again, these rust fungi will be very specific for the type of host that they infect. So the rust which you get on rows will be very different from the rust that you get on wheat. To make things slightly more confusing, wheat itself can actually be infected by three entirely different species of rust. They're given names which kind of reflect their colour, something called black rust, yellow rust and brown rust, three entirely different species. Fortunately, in the UK, we only get two of them at the moment. We don't get stem rust. But there is three different species of rust that we get on wheat, and you can get rust on lots of other plants. They grow in the plant in a similar way to the powdery mildews, but they produce their spores slightly differently. So what happens in this case is when the fungus has finally reached the sporulation stage, they produce these great big pustules on the surface of the leaf, through which the spores emerge. So what you're looking at here are these pustules with spores emerging out of them. And on a good day, if there's enough rust around, this is hawthorn that's been infected by rust. All of this brown material on the floor here is spores that have been released from that particular infected plant. So these things can produce billions of spores in a day, which can then go off and infect other plant species. Now, there is one particular rust which in historical terms is supposed to be very important. This thing is coffee rust. And allegedly, coffee rust is the reason that we in the UK are now known as a nation of tea drinkers. And the story is supposed to be that up until the 1870s, we were a nation of coffee drinkers. And we used to have lots of coffee houses in places like London. So insurance agencies such as Lloyd's of London and all those sorts of things were set up in coffee houses. And many of the insurance companies were set up in coffee houses. Long before Starbucks, we had lots of coffee houses. And most of our coffee was coming from colonies such as Ceylon or Sri Lanka, and that they were growing coffee, effectively. And then in 1870, their coffee was infected by an epidemic of this thing called coffee rust, and effectively it wiped out coffee production. Within a year or so, it wiped out coffee production in Sri Lanka. As a result, what they did in Sri Lanka is they converted to growing tea, and therefore we started importing tea instead of coffee. And allegedly that's why we became a nation of tea drinkers, because that's what we got instead of our coffee. Coffee rust itself has spread globally since then. It spread into Africa, and in the 1970s it spread into South America. And those of us that can remember that far back will probably remember that about that time there was a hike in the price of coffee, and that was because the rust had made it into South America and was now infecting plants over there. Then there are a few other kind of fungal-like diseases that occur. Potato blight is one that I'm sure many people are familiar with. This is the thing that was responsible in many ways for the Irish potato famine of the 1840s. For those that can't remember or don't know much about that, the population of Ireland before the potato famine was about 8 million people. After the Irish potato famine, it was about 5 million people. About a million plus of those were people that had died of starvation, and the rest of them were people that had emigrated because of the potato blight. As a fungus, what it does is a number of things. It will get onto the leaves of the plant where it will cause these lesions, and it will eventually cause, this is a bit quicker than it would happen in nature, of course, it will eventually cause blight and the whole plant will die. What it can also do is get into the tubers of the potato and make them inedible, so this is an infected tuber. And of course, you can also get this thing on your tomatoes, and you might have come across it in your glasshouse tomatoes. Even now, potato blight is a huge problem. Potato growers spray their crops about 20 times a season as a way of trying to control potato blight. And it costs the industry worldwide around £3 billion a year to control potato blight. So it is still a huge problem as a pathogen. Other types of diseases, fungal diseases that you might be familiar with, are these things that we refer to as post-harvest diseases. So these are the sorts of things you see on your fruit and your vegetables at home. And there's a number of these types of diseases, things such as botrytis that you will often see on fresh fruit, penicilliums, this type of morphology, and this thing known as anthracnose that you will see on a lot of tropical fruits. You'll see it on bananas, you'll see it on things like mangoes, where you get these black sunken lesions. One of the interesting things about this as a pathogen is that it's a pathogen which will infect the fruits out in the field. So mangoes will get infected out in the field, but the fungus will then stop at a certain growth stage. It will become what we refer to as quiescent, and you won't know that the fungus is there. And when those fruits, what happens with a lot of these fruits is they will get sent to countries like the UK in an unripe state. And when you buy them from the supermarket, they're usually solid and they're green and they're not ripe, and they won't have any signs of anthracnose on them. As that fruit then starts to ripen, that then triggers the fungus to become aggressive, and it's as the fruit ripens that the anthracnose will then start taking on these black sunken lesions. It will start to become aggressive and infect inside the fruit. And I'm sure you've come across, or those of you that have bought mangoes have often bought these things, store them at home, as they ripen, and if you want them to ripen, because that's when they taste good, you'll suddenly see these black sunken lesions starting to develop in them. That's this thing called anthracnose, which has got into the fruits. Of course, the other ones which are in the news at the moment are diseases of trees. Those of us that are old enough will remember in the 1960s Dutch elm disease being a major problem in the UK and wiping out about 90% of our elm trees. More recently, we've had a couple of other tree diseases that have become important in the UK. This thing known as sudden oak death, which has killed a lot of oak trees in the United States. The fungus itself got into Europe quite a time ago now, but has mainly been found on things such as rhododendrons. It hasn't got onto our oak trees. The only trees it now seems to be infecting are things such as Japanese larch in parts of southwest England. The sort of symptoms you get are these kind of cankers and lesions developing on the stems, and then you get these blight kind of lesions on the leaves. And then the other one, which has been quite topical at the moment, and is actually quite good for us as plant pathologists in some ways, because it means we've got into the news and it means the government are finally taking a bit of interest about plant pathology, is this thing called ash dieback, which was getting into the news last year. And these are the sorts of symptoms that you get because of ash dieback. The likelihood is that this has probably been in the UK for quite a few years. It's just that it's only recently that people have really started noticing that it's here. Now, not all fungal plant pathogens are bad. There are occasions when they are actually quite good. This is one which I quite like, partly because of its name and partly because of one or two other things that I'll mention in a minute. But this is a fungus known as maize smut. This is what it does to the maize. You get these, what are referred to as smutted ears. And this thing here is a tumour effectively forming on here, which just contains masses of spores. And in parts of Central America, this is considered as a delicacy, the maize smut. And what they do, it's supposed to have lots of health benefits. They sell it in tins, they make it into soups, they put it into tortillas. It's got a name in Mexico, which is huitlacoche. I was told that the literal translation for that is black excrement. Nice name for it, and I think that's probably why they don't use it. It's certainly why the Americans don't use that, because they are now marketing this thing, but they like to market it under the name the Mexican truffle. So if you go to America and you see on the menu Mexican truffle, it's this thing here. It actually tastes okay. It tastes sort of like a mushroomy kind of taste. except in Mexico where they fill it with chilies. So it's far too, this tin here was just full of chili, so it was too hot to taste anything. But anyway, that is sold as a product, and that's a fungal infection. And then there's also some grapes which are deliberately infected with botrytis to form a kind of infection which was referred to as the noble rot. And it's this that then results in some of these distinct premium sweet wines, such as the Botrytis Semillons or the Sauternes from the Bordeaux region. And this, again, you can get a premium because of the infection with the botrytis. Okay, so that's a little bit on diseases. For the final few minutes, I want to talk a little bit about diagnostics and the sort of things we're doing there, and just a little bit about control. The reason, so a lot of my work at the moment is being done on disease diagnostics and trying to understand ways of improving ways to diagnose plant diseases. And what we're really trying to do is develop rapid diagnostic techniques that we could undertake out in the field. So you go out into the field, you could find a plant, and you could then test it out in the field to work out what it is that's causing disease on it. Now, in some cases, you can work out what those diseases are fairly simply. You can look at the visual symptoms, and from that, and you can make use of reference books or your own knowledge and work out what it is that's causing disease. So if it's a powdery mildew or a rust, it's fairly easy to diagnose. But there are many occasions where you can have lots of different things causing essentially the same kinds of symptoms. So I've got three pictures down here, only two of which are diseases, even though they all look very similar. So two of these are caused by bacteria, but that middle picture, although it looks like it might be a pathogen, is actually caused by heat stress on the plant. Very similar symptoms. So there may be occasions where you need some more elaborate diagnostics to work out if there's a pathogen present. Sometimes your disease might be novel, so you might need to develop some diagnostic approaches for that. And often the best way to control your disease is at the early stages of infection, before it's established too much. So again, if you've got some rapid diagnostics, you might be able to work out what's out there. Now, as part of my research on diagnostics, I've been very lucky in many ways in that a lot of my research over the last 10 years has been on diseases of coconuts. And I always recommend to the students that if you're going to work on a disease, work on something like coconuts, because coconuts have this habit of growing in tropical countries near to beaches. That's where they grow, okay? So it means you have to go to these terrible places like this to go and do your work. It's also an important plant in these parts of the world. In many of these countries, it's referred to as the tree of life because there are so many uses of the coconut. It can be used for food, drink, building materials, fuel, income. There's lots of many uses. And also, it's supposed to be very healthy. I took this picture when I was in Malaysia last year. And I just saw this in a shop, which is an advert for coconut oil. And in this case, what they're telling us is that coconut oil, apart from making sure that you lose weight and that you have the right blood cholesterol level, it also cures all these illnesses such as AIDS and SARS and everything else. So it's really good stuff if you can get hold of your coconut oil. All right? Cures all known diseases. I'm not totally convinced about that, so don't believe everything I say. But that's what they said on that advert. Anyway, the disease that I work with a lot is this disease caused by phytoplasma, and that has some major effects on the coconut. And in particular, it caused this lethal disease. So instead of getting those nice coconut plantations that were on the last picture, you end up with plantations that look something like this. And this is caused by bacteria getting in there, and essentially it destroys the coconut palms. This is in Jamaica, and there's a disease that's present through much of the Caribbean that does this. This is in Ghana, and again, same sort of symptoms. And if you look at the coconuts, you can see that they're all black and rotting because of this bacterial infection. So this is quite an important disease. And so what we've been doing is trying to develop rapid ways of diagnosing this disease and being able to diagnose it out in the field rapidly. Now, there are a number of possible ways that you can do disease diagnostics out in the fields. One method which is used for disease diagnostics is something called a lateral flow device. And this is a kind of technology that's used in things such as pregnancy test kits. It's a technology based on antibodies. And you can develop this for some plant pathogens, and it's been developed for a number of viral plant pathogens where you can buy these test kits, you can take them out to the field and test for specific viruses. The trouble is, it's not a particularly sensitive technique, and it's also quite difficult to develop for more complex organisms such as bacteria and fungi, because it's difficult to find antibodies with the right specificity. This was a slide which kind of shows how the technology works. I'm not going to go into much detail about it, but essentially what you do is you extract a bit of sap from your plant, and in these test kits there are quick ways of doing that, and then you apply that sap to something called a release pad, which is in this lateral flow device. So this is what the lateral flow device would look like if you took it apart. This is what it looks in reality, a little plastic strip. If you take it apart, it looks like this. It has a release pad. You apply your sample to that. If it's got any pathogen in it, it binds to antibodies, and then those antibodies will move, because you've got moisture in there, it'll move through this strip over about 5 minutes towards the absorbent pad. So it moves. Everything moves in that direction. And then the antibodies will stick. The antibodies are covered in a coloured latex beads, and they will stick to strips on here. And it's these which then develop into these lines on the lateral flow device. And essentially, the thing is designed in such a way that you get just one line showing up if it's a negative result, and you'll get two lines showing up in a positive result. And so you can do these assays, take them out in the field, 5 minutes, you've got a positive-negative assay test for your pathogen. That's useful for some pathogens, but it doesn't work for all. And certainly when we tried to develop it for our bacteria, we couldn't get a good lateral flow device technique. Oops. So there are other approaches that you can use out in the field. One of them is to use DNA-based approaches, where you try and design things that you can use in something known as polymerase chain reaction tests. The idea is that what you would do is you would extract total DNA from your test plant, and then you would design some primers that are specific to a sequence of the pathogen that you're trying to detect. You would put that DNA into a PCR reaction with those primers, and if the pathogen was present, they would amplify up the DNA from that pathogen, and you would be able to see it on something such as a gel by gel electrophoresis. And this is what a PCR machine would look like, and that's the kind of result you would look for, positive results, negative results, telling you which ones are infected. Trouble with this as a technique is, first of all, when it comes to field detection, it's not really practical, because these things are quite bulky machines, and they have to be run off mains power, so it's difficult to take them out into the field. And also, there's a lot of problems with these sorts of things with contamination of samples, because there's a lot of opening up of tubes and closing tubes, and when you're running gels, lots of things can come out of those tubes and contaminate your samples. So you end up often getting things that we call false positives. So most diagnostics labs these days wouldn't use conventional PCR and the idea of running gels because of all these contamination problems. Instead, what they would normally do now is do something called real-time PCR, where the advantage is that once you've set your reactions up in a tube, you close that tube and you never have to reopen it again. The way that it works is it detects the amplification in real time, so you get essentially something which looks like this, which is absorbance or fluorescence that's being produced by your sample over time in this direction. And a positive would look like that, where you see positive amplification, and that would be a negative. So these sorts of things you can do in a closed tube kind of system. But again, it has problems that, first of all, it's quite expensive, and it's not really the sort of thing you can make into a portable kit. This is a portable real-time PCR machine. It's not that portable, as you can see there. And that would only do about 12 samples at a time. So the method that we've been developing is to use a different type of amplification of DNA, and this is something called loop-mediated isothermal amplification. And the advantage of this as a diagnostic technique is, first of all, it's much quicker than PCR. You can get a positive reaction certainly within 30 minutes. In some of our assays, within 10 or 15 minutes, you will get a positive amplification. So you'll see positive results in 10 to 15 minutes. Added to that, you don't have to purify the DNA as much as you would for PCR to do it in this method. We've been using a DNA preparation method, which essentially involves taking a little bit of plant material, putting it in this buffer in these bottles with a few steel beads, shaking that for 2 minutes, and then applying some of that solution directly into our reaction mixtures. And that's all the purification you need to do. Okay? Here's some examples of us doing this out in the field in Ghana. Fortunately, for our coconut diseases, we don't have to do that, and anyway, health and safety won't let me do that. But the idea of climbing up a tree to get your sample isn't good. Instead, we take trunk borings, as you can see here. So we just drill a hole in the trunk, take a little bit of the trunk tissue, put it into this bottle, and shake that up, and that's the DNA we use. As you can see, they won't even let me do this in Ghana. I have to stand and watch. But they do that, and here we can see them happily shaking away these bottles. Once you've done that extraction, then the machine that you use to analyse the results is also a small portable machine. It's this thing here. It's a machine that's been developed by a company called Optigene here in the UK. And the machine itself is battery operated, it's lightweight, it's portable. You can take it out into the field, and all you have to do is you can set up your reactions in advance back in the lab, or you can set up all your tubes back in the lab because they're stable at room temperature. Take them out to the field, add your DNA samples, put them in the machine, and 10 to 15 minutes you can see your positive results or negative results. And these are some tests that we did. In this particular case, what we've got here is eight samples. We did eight samples there, eight samples there, same eight samples. We tested them with primers here to make sure that they all amplified, so these were for plant DNA, to make sure that all of our DNA extractions have been good. And then in the top, we also tested those same samples for the phytoplasma. You can see that all of them, apart from our water control, amplified with the plant primers, so they were all good DNA extractions, and only one of them had the phytoplasma. And you can see we're running time across this axis here. We were getting amplification in about 15 minutes. So out in the field, from sample to positive result, 20 minutes, including the DNA extraction. Okay. These assays don't just get used for phytoplasmas. We're doing a lot of this work with people up at York at the Food Environmental Research Agency, and they've developed assays for Phytophthora morum, which is sudden oak death, botrytis, and plenty of viruses. And also, as soon as ash dieback started causing the problems last year, they developed an assay for ash dieback within 2 weeks. And the Forestry Commission have bought some of these machines and are now using them out in the field for ash dieback. They've also got these machines at Heathrow Airport for planting material coming in, and they're using this assay for diagnostics all over the place. It's not just for plant pathogens you can use it. You can use it for human animal pathogens. You can use it for authenticating food products. There are assays, for example, for being able to tell you whether you've got horse meat in your food or not, again, based on DNA detection of horse meat DNA. So you can develop these assays for all sorts of things. All you need to do is develop suitable primers and then suitable validation. So the final thing for a couple of minutes, I'm not going to dwell on much, is control of plant diseases, because I'm sure that's the bit that's most important to most people. I've told you about all these diseases and how much damage they can cause, and what you really want to know is how to get rid of them or how to control them. And essentially, when it comes to controlling plant diseases, there are sort of four main ways that we would go about doing this. One of them is what we refer to as cultural practices, so that's managing the way you grow your plants properly. One of them is to use chemicals, and you can buy all sorts of chemicals that could potentially control your plants, various fungicides to control fungi. Another approach is biological control, which is essentially using antagonistic microbes. So you can buy these products off the shelf, the various ones that are kind of described here or marketed here, where you've got products which contain a particular organism. So this thing here, called Mycostop, contains a fungus called mycorrhizal fungi, and in theory those mycorrhizal fungi are supposed to, they're present in that product, you put that on your plant, and that then is supposed to colonize the plant and prevent the pathogens from getting in there. So there are all these kind of biological control methods that you can use. And the other way that we can control diseases is to make use of natural resistance genes that would occur within plants. And so plant breeders will be developing or finding resistance genes and breeding them into commercial cultivars of particular plants. So when you buy these things from these seeds gardening centres, a lot of those may well have resistances already built into them against particular pathogens. The way resistance genes work, as I say, is that they will get bred into your commercial cultivars. And you kind of have to, there's lots and lots of different resistance genes. So resistance itself is actually quite a complex situation. You tend to have lots of resistance genes against different pathogens and even against different isolates of your pathogens. And they kind of work in a kind of interesting way, in that what happens is your pathogen, as part of its infection process, is producing molecules to allow it to cause disease on the plant. So it produces molecules that we refer to as elicitors, and it pumps these into a plant in order to cause disease. And what the resistance genes in the plants do is they're designed to recognize these elicitors that the pathogen is pumping out. And when they recognize these elicitors, what they do is they elicit a defense response in the plant. Often that defense response is something that we call a hypersensitive response, where the plant will actually kill its own cells as a way of restricting the plant from the pathogen from getting any further. So here we've got some powdery mildew on different leaves of a plant, and here we can see the fungus infecting. And here we can see resistant ones, where you can see little brown lesions, which is where the plant has caused the plant cell death to prevent the pathogen from getting any further. Okay? And what your plant breeders will be doing is finding resistance genes in natural, in wild relatives of crop species, and then breeding them into the crop plants, and then they will be testing these things out in the field and kind of come up with commercial cultivars that are resistant to the pathogens that are out there. Now, that would all work perfectly, except that pathogens have this horrible habit of evolving and constantly changing. And so when you're spraying your crops with a fungicide or when you're putting out resistance genes, that's putting selection pressure on your pathogens, and your pathogens then evolve to overcome it. And to give an example, and there's lots of examples I can give, but I'll just give this one, which is a yellow rust pathogen in Australia. This pathogen first arrived in Australia in 1979, and when it got there, what we've got on the bottom here is different wheat lines with resistance genes in them. So each of these is a different line of wheat with a different resistance gene in it, and here we can see the pathogen has infected just one line of wheat. Within 2 years, that pathogen had evolved to overcome another resistance gene. So here it's growing on another cultivar of wheat. And within a couple of years, it had overcome another one. And then a few years later, it had overcome another one. So pathogens are constantly evolving to overcome resistance genes. They're constantly evolving to overcome fungicides, to become resistant to fungicides. Pathogen populations are constantly changing. We like to say that that's the reason that plant pathologists always have a job. But what we're really trying to do is control these things, not allow that to happen. So we're trying the best we can to manage these sorts of things. And there's a number of ways that we could potentially do that. Possibly, instead of breeding resistance genes into plants, we might be able to speed this process up by using genetic engineering to introduce them into plants. That may or may not be a good thing to do. It's a controversial thing to do, but it might be possible to clone resistance genes and then pyramid more resistance genes into a single cultivar of a particular plant. So you've got lots of them present in one. There are also different types of chemicals being developed, one which activate defense responses in plants. There's also the idea of developing alternative forms or new types of biological control, other types of microbes that you might be able to use in biological control. And so there's lots of things that people are doing to try and control diseases, but of course, despite all this, our pathogens are still evolving. So what we generally recommend is lots of integration of different techniques to try and control diseases. That sometimes you use fungicides, sometimes you make use of resistance, sometimes you use biological control. There's lots of different alternative ways of trying to control your diseases. That's about all I think that I wanted to say. I've got to thank you, but I've also got, if anyone's interested, I've got some 3D glasses so you can have a look at some fungal infections in 3D. This is powdery mildew, and that's some plant hairs coming off. So if anyone wants to have a look at that while they're having their lunch, I've got a couple of pictures in 3D. Fungal spores emerging from the surface, and on this one there's fungus growing across the surface, and you'll be able to see the spores on the surface, and you'll also be able to see these structures coming off. So I've got some 3D glasses here which you can pass around, or maybe I'll pass them around, and I've been told not to trip up on the wire. And then you can ask me some questions while you're having a look at the pictures. There you go. Hopefully they show up all right on there. It's a bit difficult with this light in here, but I want these back afterwards. No sweets? No, you don't get sweets. Do you want another? Oh, you've got enough there, haven't you? There you go, have a look. Is it showing up okay, or is it too bright? You might have to get closer to the screen. It won't work on there, will it? If you need to get closer to the screen, then you should be able to see the hairs of the leaf coming out at you. And what you might also be able to see is these are the spores, but also these structures coming off like this, which are growing, coming away from the leaf surface. So these are spores coming away from the leaf surface. I always love it, this, because I can see all these people with these silly glasses on this side. I do it for the students. You ought to put them down now. The other one is this one, where hopefully you can see the spores coming away from the surface of the leaf. Does it show up okay? Yeah? So that's to give you an idea. I mean, I showed you the video of how these things grow, but that's the fungus growing away from the surface of the leaf there. And the mycelia, those white bits of powdery mildew, are the bits that are growing across the surface underneath. Okay, thank you very much. I guess you're allowed to ask me questions, aren't you?
Clap first.
Oh, you've got to clap? Okay. Go ahead. Yes, they have membranes, but they don't have any wall. So most bacteria have a cell wall around them as well, a rigid wall. But the phytoplasms themselves, they lack that. So they've lost their cell wall completely. They just have the membrane around the outside. And because of that, they kind of form all sorts of different shapes. So they don't have a solid shape. You'll see them, sometimes you'll see them as elongated shapes. Sometimes they'll be round. We refer to them as pleomorphic in that they take up lots of different shapes. Yeah. And they only live in the phloem of the plant as well. So they don't spread outside the phloem. And I think that's probably something to do with the osmotic pressure in there. It kind of keeps them together.
In your diagnostic,
what stage do you get in mold and plantations? Are you doing preventative capacity or are you waiting for services? It's a little bit of both. So usually it's that they say they've got a disease and then we get a project together. I mean, in the case of the more recent stuff in Ghana on the coconut, what's kind of happened is that we've known about this disease for a long time, but what we were able to get was some money to try and develop these improved diagnostics. So instead of the old diagnostics, which in Ghana what they had to do was they would have to take samples and then they would have to take them back to their labs, which were a long way from the field. And often they didn't even have the right equipment in those labs. Certainly the ones that we were going to, they wouldn't have the right equipment. What we were then doing was trying to, so we got project money to try and develop quicker, easier diagnostic methods that we could take into the field. But in other places, it may be that we're trying to do this in a preventative way, that now that we've got these techniques, we can tell people, look, you tell us what disease you want us to develop an assay for, and we can do that and take it out there. That sort of makes sense.
Yes.
We would design an assay to detect a particular pathogen, and we would do that based on the sequence. We would have to know the sequence of that pathogen to start with. We would then design what we call the primers to amplify that bit of DNA. And so we can develop different types of tests. So we could develop a very specific test for a particular species of a bacterium, or we could develop a more generic test that might detect more pathogens. So on our phytoplasma side, what I've done is I've developed a generic test which detects all phytoplasmas, because there's lots of different types of phytoplasma. And then we've also developed very specific ones which will detect just the coconut one or just a different phytoplasma. But yes, they would then be essentially, what they do is they synthesize DNA as part of the way that the method works. Could it be used to detect things such as rhizopus? Yes, it could. Rhizopus is probably something, whether you would need to develop a test for that, in that rhizopus develops very rapidly and is very visual symptom, so you can see very quickly that you've got rhizopus as a fungal infection. If you could detect it, I mean, the problem with some of these things is knowing when to detect, you could detect it at an early stage, but that would require an awful lot of sampling, and whether it's worth it for rhizopus, given that rhizopus takes off so quickly anyway, I don't know. But yes, you could easily develop a test for rhizopus. Yeah.
Where do you, as a sort of specialist, feel that we are in terms of fighting plant disease? Are we sort of on the, you know, are we winning or are we sort of on the losing?
We're winning against some diseases, and we can win and we can beat a disease, but the disease usually then, as with antibiotics, with human medicine, they develop, you know, you develop superbugs or you develop strains which can overcome your protection mechanisms. So we're kind of keeping things under control, I suppose, is probably the best we're doing. The data I gave at the start kind of showed crop losses of about 10 to 15% annually due to diseases. That particular data was actually from 1980. There was a recent survey in 2005 on essentially the same sort of thing, and the numbers were effectively the same, 10 to 15% losses. The difference is that over those 20 years, the amount of yield that's being produced is a lot higher. So we're getting 10 to 15% losses, but we're getting 10 to 15% losses on a much higher overall yield, so we're getting more production. So we're kind of on top of things. Things aren't getting worse, but I mean, things like potato blight is still there. It's been there since 1840s, or it's been causing problems in Europe since 1840s. You know, we can spray fungicides, but we haven't eradicated it. It's still there. No more? I'm sure everyone's getting hungry. That's probably why. Okay, well, thanks very much, and I'll let you get on with it.